From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Marilyn Morning. What will President Obama's executive order on immigration mean for thousands in Maryland? We talk with an immigration lawyer and a woman personally affected by the order. Then, it's been more than a year since Governor O'Malley signed the Firearm Safety Act. We speak with a panel of experts to assess its effectiveness and the future of gun legislation in Maryland. Plus, it's the time of year when families gather for the holidays. We bring you the story of a woman with a lot of family to celebrate with. And the Baltimore Museum of Art marks its 100th anniversary this weekend by reopening the grand entrance on Art Museum Drive at the top of the staircase, as well as quite a few other renovations. BMA Director Doreen Bolger joins Tom Hall to talk about it. Now, news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
Good morning. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. As you've been hearing on NPR, President Barack Obama issued an executive order last night promising that, at least for now, about 5 million people who entered the country illegally will not face deportation.
I know some of the critics of this action call it amnesty. Well, it's not. Amnesty is the immigration system we have today. Millions of people who live here without paying their taxes or playing by the rules, while politicians use the issue to scare people and whip up votes at election time. That's the real amnesty, leaving this broken system the way it is. Mass amnesty would be unfair. Mass deportation would be both impossible and contrary to our character.
Tens of thousands of Marylanders are affected by the president's action, including Yesenia Meija, who lives in Baltimore. She entered the country illegally from Mexico more than a decade ago, and she joins me now in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also with me here in the studio is Elizabeth Alex, lead organizer for the Central Maryland region of Casa de Maryland, an immigrant advocacy group. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. And with us by phone is Vaughn Doan. She's an immigration lawyer in Columbia, Maryland. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Thanks for being with us. Yesenia, you have a five-year-old son who was born in America, so he's an American citizen. You're one of the millions of Americans who no longer face the threat of deportation under this order for the time being. Tell me what this means for you.
I still can't believe it, and I was telling Elizabeth that it's like... I have tears want to come out of my eyes because it's something that we have been waiting and we have been fighting for this. At least to get a work permit is going to open my, it's going to open doors a little bit more. I'm going to feel more secure. I'm going to get out of that shadow. I can get a better job. I can have a better future for my son. And one big reason is that I'm not going to have that fear anymore to be one day deported and you keep my son away from me.
You mentioned hopes for a better job in the list of things that you think this means for you. Are you able to work now?
If I'm able to work
now. Are you able to have a job before this order?
I used to work at restaurants and bus person and cleaning jobs, but I couldn't get a teaching job or a work at a government place.
So what kind of job do you intend to apply for now? Are you going to look for a particular kind of job?
I've been having a lot of offers because I've been working and helping the community a lot. And I've been volunteering in Creative Alliance, that is a community art center. They have offered me to be a teacher, instructor there. Also, I participate a lot in Be More Fit for Healthy Babies. They have offered me job here, there too, to be a community leader or to work for the Highland Town Clinic. And Early Head Start. There's another place that I have been part of it, and they offer me also a teaching job.
lots of options. According to a report released this week by the Pew Research Center, there are 250,000 people living in Maryland who entered the country illegally. Elizabeth, let me ask you, how significant are the actions President Obama took last night for these people?
I think, the community is seeing this as a really strong step forward. It's not the ultimate solution, obviously. It's not legislation. It's not a comprehensive solution. But for thousands of people here in Baltimore and across the state of Maryland, this is a huge step forward. You just heard from Jasenia, and her story is not the only one. There are thousands of families like that. They're going to be able to come out of the shadows and live without that fear of deportation.
Von Doan, how many people in Maryland might this affect?
You stated that number from the Pew Report, which was just released 2 days ago, but is based on statistics that was taken back in 2012. So just keep that in mind. The problem is that the plan outlined by the president may have a disproportionately less significant effect in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, because although this area has experienced and has continued to experience the most significant growth, 15% in the undocumented population, the plan outlined by the president is most of the people will benefit have to have a USC or U.S. citizen child or lawful permanent resident child. And in that same Pew report, they mentioned that for whatever reason, the children here, there's a 1 to 15 ratio, meaning that for every 15 children under U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident child, only one parent may be undocumented.
So I'm sorry, let me make sure I'm following. You're saying, I think, that compared to the rest of the country, a smaller proportion of families in Maryland will be affected by this executive order, a smaller proportion of the parents here have children who are U.S. citizens.
Correct. So, if you look at it on the bright side of things, there are people who are still going to benefit, but it's not as going to be proportionally as significant for as it would be in the rest of the nation.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Von Doan. She's an immigration lawyer in Columbia, Maryland. Also with me is Yesenia Meija, a woman who entered the country illegally from Mexico more than a decade ago, and Elizabeth Alex, lead organizer for the Central Maryland region of Casa de Maryland, an immigrant advocacy group. At the Baltimore Immigration Summit put on by Towson University last month, Sheena Wadhawan, a Casa de Maryland's legal program manager, talked about the possibility of President Obama issuing an executive order like the one he issued last night.
But what will be created? An underclass, non-citizens, whose labor we can exploit and enjoy and build our economy off of, but who cannot vote, who can be convicted by a jury that they cannot serve on. Is that an American democracy? That's it? That's where we're going?
Elizabeth, from your perspective, is that essentially what we've entered into now with this executive order, a sort of a subculture?
I mean, like I said, we are one step forward from where we were 2 days ago, but we have a long way to go before our immigration system is completely reformed and before we really are fulfilling our complete American values and bringing people into the fold of American citizenship.
We reached out to the office of Maryland's only Republican representative in Congress, Andy Harris. They did not respond to our request, but here's what he told the Baltimore Sun. Quote, "My parents fled communism and legally immigrated to the United States because they believed the United States was a nation governed by laws. The president's potential illegal actions threatened the fundamental belief of Americans in the rule of law," close quote. Van Doan, you've been an immigration lawyer for 12 years. And do I understand correctly that President George W. Bush issued a similar kind of executive order?
It is. When people make broad statements like that, I think a large part of this myth that they're trying to spread to the media, making this sound like immigration reform. Elizabeth Alex has already pointed out this is nowhere near reform, and I think that's where people are demonizing or are able to demonize this action. It's an executive action. It's based on his presidential authority, which many presidents before him have exercised, namely George Bush. And just to give you, I strongly believe, I'm a great student of history, and history has shown us that at least 11 presidents have exercised this authority, and most recently, you know, George Bush Sr. Just to give you a background on this, Clinton and Bush both, in response to IRA-IRA, which was the Illegal Immigration Reformation Act, had put great limitations on how people were going to be able to enter this country legally. And in response to that, they, because of the hardships experienced by those who were already here, both the Clinton and Bush administration had established guidelines and limits for when authorities could exercise leniency in dealing with such situations. And those guidelines were then driven by complaints as a bipartisan group of the members of Congress in 1999 letters to the Clinton Justice Department, where they said that the deportation process was unfair and resulted in unjustifiable hardships. And
Vaughn, I have to interrupt you. Vaughn, I have to interrupt you. We're almost out of time, and I want to ask Yesenia very briefly, if this does turn out to be temporary, how will you handle that?
Well, then people have to realize, but let me just let you know that the Bush administration, their actions then resulted in affecting 40% of the undocumented population at the time. So it was broad and sweeping as well. And
we are flat out of time. Vaughn Doan, I appreciate your talking to us, and I thank all of you. Yesenia Meija lives in Baltimore. Elizabeth Alex is lead organizer in the Central Maryland region for Casa de Maryland, an immigrant advocacy group. Vaughn Doan, as I mentioned, is an immigration lawyer practicing in Columbia. We have a link to video of the president's speech at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. After the news, we look at Maryland's new gun law. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Good morning. I'm glad you're with us here on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland has a reputation for being tough when it comes to gun control. As of last year, Maryland outlaws 45 kinds of assault rifles, bans magazines that hold more than 10 rounds, and requires strict background checks before citizens can buy guns. But the director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, Daniel Webster, does not consider Maryland's gun laws as strict as that may sound. He's convening a series of seminars on gun control over the next few weeks, starting with one today at noon. Daniel Webster joins me on the phone. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
Also joining us by phone is Attorney General-elect Brian Frosch, a panelist in this afternoon seminar. He has chaired the Judicial Proceedings Committee in the Maryland Senate for 12 years. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And Lauren Beraldi, chief of the Gun Violence Task Force for the District Attorney in Philadelphia. She'll be in Baltimore for the panel and joins us by phone now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Daniel Webster, why do you say Maryland's gun laws are not as strict as their press coverage might imply?
When you look deeper into our laws and some of the laws that are what I consider pretty critical to prevent the diversion of guns to criminals and other prohibited people, they're not all that strong in important ways.
In what way?
Well, it's not so easy to actually convict someone for failure to comply with background check laws. There are a variety of things that prosecutors have to prove, that the gun was a permanent transfer as opposed to a temporary loan. They have to, importantly, actually prove a willful violation.
You're
of
talking
the law.
Now, if I understand correctly, you're talking about what we generally call straw purchases, where
yes,
somebody buys a gun and it ends up in the hands of someone who would not be eligible to purchase a gun.
That's exactly right. Yes, and that's really what's so critical and what we've been striving for a number of years to get the right kind of policies in place.
Well, is it only a violation of law on the part of the original purchaser if the intent at the time of purchase was to transfer the gun to an ineligible purchaser? Or is it ever legal for someone to buy a gun and hand it over to somebody else?
Well, in Maryland, when you're talking about a transfer of a handgun, you're required by law to only transfer in instances in which the purchaser has passed a background check. And that is the part of the law that I think is the weakest in terms of relatively high standards for conviction. And when you get a conviction, it's only a misdemeanor. And so we don't see many cases prosecuted. When there are prosecutions and convictions, very rarely do you see much consequences.
Lauren Beraldi from the Philadelphia Prosecutor's Office, you had its gun violence task force. Are straw purchases a problem in Philadelphia?
Yes, straw purchases are actually the reason that the gun violence task force was created back in 2007. It is a collaboration between the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, the Philadelphia Police Department, and the State Attorney General's Office. And we have 18 agents from the State Attorney General's Office who are tasked with investigating straw purchases. So we've, for the past 7 years, have been working on this problem in Philadelphia.
Do you think you have a handle on it?
I think we're working on the problem in Philadelphia. I mean, it is very difficult to prove. I mean, we rely on our gun store owners who have a very good relationship with our agents, to make phone calls and say, hey, look, something doesn't seem right with how this purchase is going down. We investigate every gun that's recovered in Philadelphia by the Philadelphia Police Department. That information is passed off to our agents, and they run checks on those guns, and they track down the gun owners, and they take investigations from there. So I would say that we're in a lot different position than we were 7 years ago. We have great partnerships with gun stores, which is something that had never happened before. But to say that the problem no longer exists would not be a fair statement.
Brian Frosch, as committee chair, you played a big role in shaping the Firearm Safety Act last year. Do you think there's a big hole in it?
Well, I think it is difficult to prove the crime of being a straw purchaser. But we did a couple of things in the Firearm Safety Act, the law we passed last year, to reduce straw purchasers. First, what we did was we said anybody who wants to purchase a handgun must get a license, and to get the license, you must give your fingerprints to the state police. That's proved to be a very strong deterrent in other states that have similar requirements, and I'm talking about New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Connecticut. They have lower rates of gun violence and gun deaths than do states that are similar demographically. So we expect that will reduce straw purchases. In addition, we gave our state police authority to oversee the sales through gun dealers, to look at their inventories, to look at their sales, and to determine whether they are selling to people who are disqualified or whether they're selling to people who end up transferring their purchases to people who are disqualified. So in combination, I think those two pieces of the legislation that we passed will reduce straw purchasers. That said, we did not strengthen the part of the bill that you described, the part of the law that you described earlier that makes it only a misdemeanor, and that has the high standard of having to prove that the transfer to somebody without the qualification to own a gun must be willful.
Lauren Baraldi, I read that Philadelphia just put a mother behind bars for 6 to 13 years for supplying her criminal son with a gun, which sounds pretty tough. Is there something about the law in Pennsylvania that's tougher than what we have here?
Right. So Delaware County District Attorney's Office prosecuted a 22-year-old woman by the name of Stacey Dawson, and she was providing handguns to her boyfriend, a man by the name of David Cologne. But we have a mandatory attached to straw purchases, whereby if you purchase two or more guns and illegally transfer them, it's a 5 to 10 year mandatory. If you even purchasing one gun is itself a felony, which I believe is different than what you see there in Maryland. They're very difficult cases in that if you are purchasing a gun, by definition, you do not have a record. So you're looking at, you know, a 20-year-old woman with a 3-year-old child who just went to jail for 6 to 12 years last week because she purchased two firearms for her boyfriend who was not eligible to carry in Pennsylvania because of his prior convictions.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Lauren Baraldi from the District Attorney's Office in Philadelphia. She's part of a seminar series that begins this afternoon in Baltimore. We're also talking to Daniel Webster, director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at Johns Hopkins University, and with Attorney General-elect Brian Frosch. Brian Frosch, if we can't effectively stop straw purchases, do the background checks in the 2013 law even mean anything? Because we're not actually checking the person holding the gun.
Well, we are. I mean, in the law we passed last year, you want to buy a gun, you must have the background checks, and the ability to do the background checks is enhanced by the fact that you have to give your fingerprints to the state police in order to get the license to buy it. So, yes, I mean,
But if straw purchases happen, I mean, I get what the regulatory regime is, but I don't understand what keeps somebody from buying a gun, waiting a plausible number of months and saying, somebody stole my gun. And then when that gun shows up in somebody else's hands, the purchasers, how do you enforce that?
Well, two things. We, in the same law, we made it, we require people who have lost, who have had a gun stolen or lost to report it to the police. And it's a crime if they don't. If you're determined to get around this law and to transfer a gun illegally to somebody who is not qualified to own one, if you plan long enough in advance and if you jump through all the hoops, you can probably get away with it. But keep in mind the fact that you have to go to the state police and give them your fingerprints first seems to work as a deterrent in the states that already have that requirement.
Daniel Webster, Vinnie DeMarco, the head of Marylanders to Prevent Gun Violence, argues that the 2013 law in Maryland is powerful because the murder rate in Maryland dropped by almost 1/4 in the first 7 months of this year. Is that persuasive to you?
Well, it's my business to study such things, and while I see that very encouraging, I need to see longer-term trends to have a better sense that this is not a sort of a short-term blip, and also do some comparative analysis to see the degree to which Maryland's reductions are truly different than trends going on in other states. I think Maryland made a huge step forward with its law in 2013. I do think that we will have even more effective laws if we can create a deterrent through successful prosecutions.
Lauren Baraldi, from what I've read, your gun violence task force in Philadelphia is about 3 times the size of the one in Baltimore. Is manpower a key to getting guns off the street?
Manpower and experience. The agents that work on our task force are all retired Philadelphia Police Department homicide detectives. That has really been the key to our successful prosecutions. The majority of our cases, the detectives are able to get statements and provide us with an extraordinary amount of evidence, which makes it therefore very easy to prosecute. I mean, we have an over 85% merit-based prosecution statistics for this unit over the past 7 years, and that is because of the agents that we work with and because of the experience and what they bring to the table.
Brian Frosch, let me turn to you for a political judgment. Republican Larry Hogan was endorsed by the National Rifle Association and has refused to disclose how he filled out the NRA questionnaire to get that endorsement. There's speculation on the left that he will name a superintendent of state police who might be lax in enforcing the Firearms Safety Act. What are you expecting?
Well, what I'm hoping for is that Governor-elect Hogan said that he was not going to seek to undermine the law, and that he will help enforce it and maintain it. I think it's a great opportunity for us in Maryland to save lives and prevent injuries with guns.
Daniel Webster, the Democrat in that race, Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, campaigned against Hogan as a threat to gun safety, and voters chose Hogan. Does that give him a mandate?
I don't think so at all. I don't think many people believe that Mr. Hogan won the election because of his position on guns. He certainly wasn't campaigning on guns. He was campaigning on taxes and other issues. So I think it would be a real stretch to infer that he has any sort of mandate as it relates to weakening Maryland's gun laws.
Well, I appreciate you all talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Webster is director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Lauren Beraldi is chief of the Gun Violence Task Force for the District Attorney in Philadelphia. And Brian Frosch will leave the state Senate in January to become Maryland's Attorney General. The seminar series Challenges and Opportunities to Enforcing Maryland's Gun Law begins at noon today at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. We've got more information, including a link to find out about four more seminars scheduled in the next 3 weeks. I'm Sheila Cass. There's more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1. On 88.1, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. At this time, when people are getting their families together for holiday dinners and parties, we hear from a senior who grew up in a house that was quite full on Thanksgiving, and on any day, really. As part of our senior portrait series, former producer Jamila Kay spoke with Deborah last winter at Manor Care Health Services Adelphi in Prince George's County.
Oh, everybody called me Deb, especially my family. So, and I am 62 years old. Oh, I had a big family. It was 13 of us. 13 was 7 girls and 6 boys. Sonny, Eugene, Larry, and Jackie, and then me. And then on down the line with Vanessa, Marlon, Cedric, oh, who else? Natea, Amanda. Oh my gosh. Richard, Carolyn.
So what about you? You grew up in a big family, but did you have a big family?
I did. I had the most in the family. I had 6 children. That's what I'm saying. We had a great big family. And when my mother passed, it was about 62 grandkids already. I haven't counted yet. You know, I got to put that in my book about how many we are now. You know, we came up with a musical family. My mother would play a lot of music, and my father would play a lot of music. So I knew the old stuff when they were listening to, and when I come up, you know, all the way up until my time. In the evening, that's when we talk, sit down and talk. And another thing, we had family talks, because there was so many of us that my mother couldn't take care of because my father had gone. By that time, he had gone away. So it was my mother and the older siblings, you know. And I wasn't old enough to come in there and talk. They would go in this room and sit down and talk, and I put my ear to the door. They would talk about family business. And another way that we kept it, we had a big, long table. It was a buffet table, really. And all of us had to sit at this buffet table. We had mismatched chairs, but it was enough for all of us, you know, to sit around the table and talk. And that was the old days, you know, and I think it should be more of that.
That was Deb, a resident of Manor Care Health Services Adelphi in Prince George's County. Our former producer, Jamila Kay, spoke with her last winter. We have a link to more senior portraits at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning. Up the grand steps on Art Museum Drive, there's something new. Stay tuned to 88.1.
Grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them. You see, it's in the blood. Both kids are good and mom. Blood's thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. The Baltimore Museum of Art is celebrating its 100th anniversary this weekend by reopening the grand entrance at the top of the steps on the museum's west side on Art Museum Drive and unveiling a newly reimagined entrance in their other building that's closer to Charles Street as well. In addition, a fantastic new American wing has opened to house an internationally acclaimed collection of furniture, silver, paintings, and other works of art from Maryland and beyond. And the BMA isn't nearly done with their renovations and revitalization. In the spring, they'll reopen their African and Asian collections, and next fall, a new interactive gallery will make its debut. Overseeing all of this is the BMA's director, Dr. Doreen Bolger. She's the museum's 9th director, and she is credited with lifting not only the profile of the BMA, but of the entire arts community throughout the state of Maryland. And Doreen Bolger joins me in the studio. Good morning, Doreen. Always great to see you.
Fantastic to be here, Tom.
So, it is widely documented how much thought and thoughtfulness you've invested in how the BMA relates to the art community and the community at large here in Baltimore. Let's talk for a second, because this is such an important anniversary and you've done such huge work at the museum, internally and externally, about the place of the Baltimore Museum in the panoply of art museums across the country and across the world. You know, how does Baltimore compare, or what is the contribution that you want to make with the Baltimore Museum of Art to the international world of art and art research?
Gosh, Tom, that's like 6 questions in one.
Yeah, it is.
The BMA was founded by extraordinary, insightful people here in Baltimore who came together believing that every great city needs a great museum. And they put a lot of effort and a lot of their resources into forming amazing collections that have worldwide significance. Each of these people who were our leaders then had a real vision for what this past 100 years would be like. And we owe them an enormous debt. And I think we should be inspired by the work that they've done.
John Russell Pope, who designed the Jefferson Memorial, the Tate Gallery in London, part of the National Gallery in Washington, the National Archives Building, was the designer of the BMA, which opened in 1929. Let's talk about the Merrick entrance, the one at the top of those big steps. First of all, it was closed off in 1982. Why was that decision made, and then why have you decided to reopen it?
Well, you know, in 1982, the BMA made a very forward-looking decision to add amenities to its east side. A wonderful restaurant, lobby, this super Meyerhoff Auditorium.
And we should say this is before your time.
Long before. Oh, mm-hmm. Listen, I'm just standing on the shoulders of all of those who've come before me, both staff and board and donors. So when that opened, people were concerned about a couple of very practical things and important things. The Merrick entrance was not handicapped accessible. There were issues during weather times. And we really wanted to preserve also the critical environmental conditions within the museum, the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system. When I studied art history, I never knew that I really should have studied engineering.
That's
and that to be a museum director, you really have to talk a lot to engineers and architects.
That HVAC training would have come in handy.
Yes, that certainly would have come in handy. So I at that time, people felt, well, we have that Zamosky entrance on the east side, and that would accommodate everyone. But people really missed walking up those stairs. And we've been so fortunate to be able to find solutions, practical solutions that will enable us to have that door open again. And I think it's a gathering place for the community. I mean, I imagine we've had some things there performed there in the past, from Wartscape to High Zero. But, you know, now it'll be more of a gathering place. And on Sunday, when we open those doors to the public, there'll be artists. One performance artist, Megan Hildebrandt, is going to be scrubbing the steps ceremonially. You know, and you'll, if you come and if you're among the first to come, you'll get your own can of Bon Ami, which is sponsoring the event. It's hilarious.
To clean the steps of
yes,
the BMA.
Yes, so we're going to clean it. We'll have a ribbon cutting. So many of our leaders in the city and the state will be there with us, our trustees.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Be exciting.
And Steve Zigger from Zigger Sneed, the architectural firm that did this, Steve's a mutual friend of both yours and mine, did a wonderful job, and he had a great respect for the work that John Russell Pope did back in the early 1920s. And he's there's a lot of work that's been done behind the walls that you're not going to see, as you say, with the air conditioning system, the heating, the sprinklers, and all that.
Well,
you really wanted to keep Pope's original vision cooking here.
Well, Pope was just an amazing architect, and we were his first museum. And the way he laid out the building, the thoughtfulness of it, the sort of intuitive logic that you experience when you walk through it. And we're so lucky that Steve Zigger loved that idea and worked to reinforce it. And we've restored a lot of details that have transformed the interior space, particularly under the leadership of our trustee, Stiles Colwell. We were very attentive to the details of what the floors would look like, how they were patterned, where were the chair rails, what colors were we using. So it's all very, you know, a very exciting time.
And of course, there's this wonderful reopening of the American Wing with this incredible collection of American art. How do all of these improvements to the building, which the curator of the American Collection, David Park Curry, said that the Pope Building was probably the best piece of art that the BMA owns, you know, and that's out of 90,000 pieces of art that you all own. But how does all this fit into this notion that, as I said, you've been so thoughtful about how the BMA fits into the community, how it contributes to the cultural life of our area?
I think that David Curry has done an installation that people will be able to connect with in so many ways. First of all, we've brought the contents of the American Wing up to 1960. So for many people, this will be work completed almost or in their lifetime. David has also juxtaposed fine and decorative arts. So you see silver intermixed with paintings. It makes a statement about how these things were used and accessible in people's homes at one time. We have underscored the diversity of American art. We have really wonderful Native American pieces that relate to the subjects of paintings they're displayed by. We feature our outstanding collection of African American art. So I think that for a broader, a diverser, a younger audience, this view of American art will be a surprise.
Well, I was over at the building earlier this week. It's gorgeous, and the collection is terrific. And congratulations on this, continuing project of getting the BMA all spanky new and shiny. So it looks and sounds great. Thanks so much, Doreen. Doreen Bolger is the director of the Baltimore Museum of Art, the celebration marking the opening of the new Merrick and Zamosky entrances, and the Dorothy McIlvaine Scott American Wing starts at 10 o'clock Sunday morning, and there will be activities for all ages until 5 o'clock that afternoon. We've got a link to more information on our website at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, the next installment in our series on religion, Living Questions. We'll talk about the role religion played in the most recent state and national elections. I hope you can join us Monday morning on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Graham,
Payam Agagasam,
and Elizabeth Sherwood.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville on the web at zekescoffee.com. Tomorrow is November 22nd. In 1633, on that date, the Ark and the Dove set sail from England, headed to Maryland with English settlers. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been listening. See you on Monday.